Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we begin a month-long series of programs devoted to the war in Vietnam. It was 30 years ago this month, in January 1973, that President Richard Nixon formally ended U.S. involvement in that conflict. Nixon promised peace with honor, but the South Vietnamese government survived only two more years before being toppled by rebel and North Vietnamese forces. U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War was one of the most divisive events in American history. It precipitated a wide range of military, political, social, and cultural issues that will be highlighted in this special series. But first, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on January 10, 1920, the League of Nations was formed. President Woodrow Wilson proposed the League of Nations in his 14-point plan to end the war to assure a lasting peace. And after the war ended, all the major nations approved his plan, except the United States. Before setting sail for France to attend the peace conference, Wilson urged voters to show their support for his peace plan by voting for the Democratic Party. People were more concerned with economic issues, however, and voted Republican. Republicans feared ongoing entangling alliances for the United States with world powers and being drawn into even more destructive wars, and they were reluctant to join the League. Wilson campaigned hard to change their minds, suffering a near-fatal stroke in the process, but he failed. The League of Nations met for the first time in Geneva on November 15, 1920, without the U.S. Over the course of the next two decades, it resolved several minor international disputes, but it wasn't powerful enough to keep the world from sliding into a Second World War. In 1946, the League was replaced by the United Nations, including the U.S., and the United States still plays a leading role in it today.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the introduction of Japanese kamikaze pilots was one of the most dramatic developments of the Second World War. What motivated these young men to fly their fatal missions, however, has been unclear to most of us, at least until now, and the publication for the first time of the manual they carried in their cockpits. "Transcend life and death," one passage reads. "When you eliminate all thoughts about life and death, you'll be able to totally disregard your earthly life. This will also enable you to concentrate your attention on eradicating the enemy with unwavering determination. And you won't precisely remember what happens upon collision, but it will be like a dream or fantasy. You'll be relaxed and a smile will crease your face. The sweet atmosphere of your boyhood days will return." Kamikaze by Albert Axel is available from Pearson Education Limited. This is Talking History.
Cheese!
To inaugurate our series on U.S. involvement in the war in Vietnam, we will focus on the air war and especially American bombing of North Vietnam. Fred Nielsen, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and the interviewer for this special series, takes up that issue with his guest, Mark Klodfelter.
Among the most controversial aspects of the Vietnam War was and remains American bombing. The United States dropped more bombs on Indochina than it did on Japan and Germany during World War II. To critics of the Vietnam War, the 1972 Christmas bombings of northern cities were savage and senseless crimes against humanity. Yet others believe that the campaign was responsible for ending the war. In their view, the major mistake was that such bombing had not come earlier. With me today to discuss the American air war in Vietnam is Mark Klodfelter, a historian at the National Defense University near Washington, D.C. He is the author of The Limits of Air Power, The American Bombing of North Vietnam. Professor Klodfelter, welcome.
Welcome to you.
One often hears comparisons between the U.S. bombing in World War II and in Indochina. Perhaps you could help us understand the comparisons. How many tons of bombs were dropped in the two wars? How many casualties resulted? And perhaps even more, are such comparisons meaningful at all?
First of all, let me start in Germany. And in Germany, you had a combined British and American bombing offensive. There we dropped about 1.2 million tons of bombs, with the bulk of those bombs falling in 1944 and 1945. That bombing killed between 305,000 and 593,000 German civilians, depending upon the totals that you take. The first figure is the American Strategic Bombing Survey figure. The second figure is from German sources. Against Japan, we dropped a much smaller amount of bombs, 147,000 tons, not even close to a million the way we did in Germany, and that was dropped during about a one-year span. But in that case, we killed 330,000 Japanese civilians, a total higher than the American total that we have for bombing in Germany. A comparison, Japanese cities were densely populated, and their industry was spread out across residential areas, so that was part of the reason for American attacks there that was so devastating, but only part. In Vietnam, in Indochina, we dropped roughly 8 million tons of bombs. Roughly 4 million will fall on the country of our ally, South Vietnam. Another 3 million will fall on Laos, and then close to 1 million will fall on North Vietnam. Of the 1 million that fall on North Vietnam, we produced roughly 60,000 dead, and that's, again, a small number compared certainly to what you had in Germany and also to what you had in Japan. Are the comparisons meaningful? I would say only from the standpoint that different types of bombing and different types of conflicts is going to give you different casualty figures. You have to remember that that World War II was a war for unconditional surrender, where we were desiring to destroy the German and Japanese governments and their way of life. Vietnam was anything but a war for unconditional surrender for the United States. There were great limits and constraints placed on the bombing, and thus you have a much smaller casualty figure than you do in World War II. So I think that's a large measure of the distinction.
The first major U.S. air campaign in Vietnam was Rolling Thunder, which ran from March of 1965 to October 1968. Could you describe that campaign for us?
President Lyndon Johnson initiated the campaign trying to do what he could militarily to achieve a stable, non-communist South Vietnam. And in the spring of 1965, South Vietnam was threatened. Part of that threat came from the Viet Cong insurgency that was that we believed was fostered almost entirely by North Vietnam. As a result, the idea was going to be we would cut off the North Vietnamese support for the Viet Cong insurgency through bombing, and thus we would start bombing in the southern areas of North Vietnam, just north of the 17th parallel, and then gradually increase our bombing up the panhandle there of North Vietnam, rolling it northward as it were, until ultimately the two key cities of Hanoi and Haiphong would come under attack, and we would attack the targets in that area. The idea was that we would cause the North Vietnamese concern. They would realize what we were doing, and they would abandon their war efforts based upon the incremental bombing and the belief that if they were to persist, that we would sooner or later attack their key targets in Hanoi and Haiphong.
You make a distinction between positive and negative political objectives. What's the difference?
Well, that's a term that I've created. Clausewitz had the term positive objectives for an attacking force and negative objectives for a defending force. I'm not that sophisticated. And when I use the terms positive and negative objectives, there's no value added to either term. It's not that one is good and one is bad. It's simply that they are different. But both sets of objectives have to be obtained to be successful in war. Now, what I mean by positive objectives are those that are achieved only through the application of military force. And negative objectives are achieved only by limiting military force. So they are in direct contrast to one another. In the case of Lyndon Johnson and the Vietnam War, his positive political objective was to achieve a stable, non-communist South Vietnam. It was threatened by collapse from external military forces under the North Vietnamese, also from internal military forces provided by the Viet Cong. So Johnson was going to have to apply some degree of military force to preserve an independent, stable, non-communist South. On the other hand, he also had negative objectives that he wanted to achieve. And those negative objectives were, there were three which were critical. One was to keep the Soviets and the Chinese out of direct intervention into the conflict. Johnson remembered the example of Korea, where the Chinese had intervened. He wanted to prohibit that if at all possible, and certainly wanted to keep the Soviet Union out of direct intervention as well. In addition, a negative objective was to keep the focus of the American public on his great society, his social welfare and reform programs for America. That was where he wanted to put his emphasis, and he thought if a war intensified in Southeast Asia, the American public would focus on that war effort, and thus the support that he was desiring for his social programs would be stripped away, because American emphasis would then go towards the war. And thirdly, a third negative objective was that Johnson wanted to keep world public opinion regarding the United States in a favorable light, and he thought if he applied too much military force against North Vietnam, then America would appear as a great bully, a Goliath, beating up on a hapless David, and that was not the image he wanted to portray.
Air Force Chief of Staff Curtis LeMay once declared that he could bomb Vietnam back into the Stone Age. Clearly there are some tensions between the military leaders and the president. I wonder what the military's perspective on the strategic bombing during Rolling Thunder was. What did they hope to accomplish?
Right. That's a famous quote that LeMay had. It comes from his memoirs that he wrote there in the summer of 1965, right after he retired as Air Force Chief of Staff. And he did indeed say, what we need to do is to bomb North Vietnam into the Stone Age. But that was not a call to begin wholesale civilian attacks in North Vietnam. Rather, what LeMay wanted to do was exactly what the term seems to imply, was to take away the ability to wage modern war, the technical means to wage modern war, away from the North Vietnamese. Now, having said that, LeMay and other Air Force generals realized that the technical means to wage modern war for the North Vietnamese was indeed limited. The North Vietnamese had roughly 7 electric power plants, 1 cement factory, 1 iron works, and that was about the extent of their industrial apparatus. To wage warfare, they needed support and assistance from the Chinese and the Soviets. But the idea was what the American air power could do, we thought, was to threaten meager industrial apparatus that the North Vietnamese had to hold it hostage, and thus cause the North Vietnamese to back down and to call off the insurgency that we believe they directed, and to call off also the North Vietnamese troops to stop sending troops and supplies down south. We had made the mightiest enemy we faced on the planet, that is the Soviet Union, back down to the threat of American air power in 1962, so during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So certainly we thought that now, with the threat posed by Ho Chi Minh and North Vietnam, certainly we could cause those guys to quake as a result of the intimidation of American air power. So that was the premise, and that was the notion. What we failed to understand was the great tenacity that the North Vietnamese had, and in many respects that tenacity undercut the efforts of Rolling Thunder.
After 1968, the war becomes Richard Nixon's war. You spoke earlier of Johnson's objectives as president. How did Nixon's differ from Johnson's?
Well, you can make a strong case that Nixon really had no negative political objectives that held back the application of military power. What he did have was a positive goal that he referred to as peace with honor. Now, this goal was different from Johnson's goal of an independent, stable, non-communist South Vietnam. That positive political objective changed in the aftermath of the Tet Offensive. So Nixon's new goal, peace with honor, was really a euphemism for getting American forces out of Vietnam with our prisoners intact, and hopefully not having the South Vietnamese regime crumble in the immediate aftermath of American withdrawal. In Nixon's own words, he said, "We are fighting for a decent interval for South Vietnam." So Nixon's goal was one that was much, much easier to achieve with any application of military force, much less air power, than had been the case for Johnson.
Perhaps the most controversial bombing campaign of the war was Linebacker II, the Christmas bombing that lasted for 11 days in December of 1972, near war's end. How was that bombing different from previous campaigns?
Well, in actuality, the targets that were hit during the so-called Christmas bombings, Linebacker II, were pretty much the same that had been attacked during Rolling Thunder. There were a couple of key differences, though. One of which was the use of B-52s as the mainstay of the air campaign. Nixon was trying to send a signal both to the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese that he was very serious in his goal of ending American participation in the war. He was trying to drive the North Vietnamese back to the peace talks that had been broken off there in mid-December to get them to conclude an agreement that they had initially signed up to at the end of October there in 1972, when Kissinger and Le Duc Tho were trying to hammer out an agreement in Paris. At the same time, though, Nixon was trying to persuade South Vietnamese President Nguyen Van Thieu that America would be there willing to provide military force if the North Vietnamese broke this agreement, which he hoped could be concluded there soon after the air campaign ended. So Nixon's goals were extremely specific. The method that he used, B-52s, was something dramatically different from what Lyndon Johnson had used in Rolling Thunder, where there the predominant bombing was with fighter bombers over North Vietnam. And again, Nixon's goals much more limited than those of Johnson earlier.
You quote Nixon, who once claimed that his biggest mistake as president was not Watergate, but the failure to bomb Vietnam earlier in the way that he did in December of 1972. For many other people, it's an article of faith that more force, more bombing of that sort, would have won the war and saved American lives. How much truth is there in such beliefs?
Well, again, my opinion only, my opinion based on a fair amount of research, that bombing earlier would have made very little difference in achieving American success in Vietnam. That is, bombing the way Nixon did in 1972 back in, say, the spring of 65 or any time prior to the Tet Offensive. And the reason for that is the character and conduct of war was very different that during the era of Lyndon Johnson than it was in 1972 for Richard Nixon. from 1965 to the time of the Tet Offensive in 68, the war was really a very infrequently waged guerrilla conflict when the bulk of the enemy forces were composed of Viet Cong, not the North Vietnamese Army in VA, but instead VC. This entire force, if you take the total number of troops they had, say, in August of 1967, equaled about 300,000 men. Of that total, a full quarter of a million were NVA, or were Viet Cong, and only 50,000 were NVA. Yet this entire force fought on an average of only one day out of 30. That is one day a month. And because of this combat infrequency, they needed very few supplies from outside of South Vietnam. In fact, for this whole 300,000-man communist army, in terms of supplies needed from outside the South, they needed only 34 tons a day to keep them going. Now, 34 tons may sound like a lot, but that is an incredibly meager amount that you could put inside of seven 2.5-ton trucks. And I don't care how much bombing of North Vietnam you do, you can't stop seven truckloads of supplies from getting down south on a daily basis. It's simply impossible to do that. But in terms of the way the war was being waged, it was so infrequently conducted that no amount of bombing would have made a significant difference on the southern war effort, or the war effort in the south during the period 65 to 68. In direct contrast to that is the war effort in 1972, where now the Viet Cong have been eliminated as a viable fighting force by coming out during the Tet Offensive. The war is waged in 1972 almost exclusively by the North Vietnamese Army, backed by large amounts of tanks and heavy artillery. They have vast logistical requirements, and thus they have targets, or air power has targets such as roads, bridges, communication lines, trains, fuel depots that are essential for that army to operate in 1972. That simply was not the case during the time period of 65 to 68 before the Tet Offensive. So what you have are very much two different wars, and the application of air power that was successful in one would not, in my opinion, have been successful in the other.
Well, Professor Klodfelter, thanks for visiting with us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
I've been talking with Mark Klodfelter, the author of The Limits of Air Power, The American Bombing of North Vietnam.
An important reason for recalling the history of American involvement in the Vietnam War is to learn from that experience. That's the subject of this week's commentary by H.R. McMaster. McMaster is a National Security Fellow at the Hoover Institution and author of Dereliction of Duty, Lyndon Johnson, Robert McNamara, The Joint Chiefs of Staff, and The Lies That Led to Vietnam.
It seemed that the 1991 Gulf War had put an end to the Vietnam Syndrome, a widely felt belief that the United States should avoid military intervention abroad. However, the painful memory of America's costly and divisive war in Vietnam retains its influence on the American psyche. Recent debates over the use of force in Afghanistan and Iraq have inspired frequent Vietnam War analogies. These simplistic analogies suit the purposes of their purveyors, because America's collective memory of Vietnam has become more symbolic than historical. To judge better the value of these predictions, we might ask what, if anything, we can learn from our nation's experience in Vietnam. Most historians, sensitive to the uniqueness and complex causality of events, would answer cautiously. For example, Earl Tilford suggested that there was only one true lesson of Vietnam. Do not become involved in a civil war in support of a nationalist cause against a communist insurgents supplied by allies with continuous borders in a former French colony located in a tropical climate halfway around the world. What good is history, however, if we cannot learn from the experience? The desire to learn from Vietnam remains one of the war's enduring legacies. But what if we learn the wrong lessons? What became known as the Weinberger-Powell Doctrine grew out of a well-meaning attempt to set clear preconditions for the use of military force, and thereby prevent another Vietnam. America would employ military force only if vital national interests were at stake, victory was the objective, War was the last resort, and a decision for war enjoyed sufficient congressional and public support. America would apply overwhelming power, achieve decisive victory, and then withdraw to avoid protracted entanglement. Critics have argued that the Weinberger-Powell Doctrine actually impeded effective foreign policy. The ambiguity of what is a vital interest, what constitutes victory, and what is overwhelming force limited the doctrine's utility. The doctrine might discourage early intervention necessary to prevent a larger conflict or permit humanitarian crises that America could otherwise stop. How, then, do we distinguish correct lessons from bad analogies and wrong lessons? First, we must become familiar with how and why Vietnam became an American war. America went to war in Vietnam in a way that was unique in American history. There was no clear decision for war. Instead of exercising leadership, President Lyndon Johnson sought to avoid a decision and endeavored to preserve a fragile consensus built on lies and deceptions. His failure to lead prevented his administration from dealing effectively with the complex problem of Vietnam. The administration's lies and deceptions permitted the circumvention of the Constitution, and, as a result, Americans were at war before they even recognized that fact. Not surprisingly, the way in which the United States went to war had a profound influence on the conduct of the war and on its outcome. Vietnam history cannot provide us with solutions to contemporary problems. It can, however, help us avoid learning the wrong lessons and recognize the inevitable Vietnam analogy for what it is, an attempt to evoke emotion rather than impart historical wisdom.
You've been listening to H.R. McMaster, the author of Dereliction of Duty, Lyndon Johnson, Robert McNamara, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the Lies That Led to Vietnam. And finally, as we do each week, we recommend to you a site where you can learn more about the subject of this week's program, the Air War in Vietnam. Joey Skidmore returns to tell you more about one such site.
One of the most extensive museum exhibits on the air war in Vietnam is on display at the United States Air Force Museum. The exhibit provides a detailed examination of the air war, but it also places that effort into the context of the entire history of the conflict. The exhibit begins by reminding us of the history of the war prior to American involvement. It then describes how the U.S. got involved and takes us through the signing of the ceasefire on January 23, 1973, American withdrawal from South Vietnam, and the lingering matters of POWs and MIAs. The conflict in Southeast Asia is a permanent exhibit at the U.S. Air Force Museum on the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio.
And that's it for this week's program. We invite you to join us again next week for the second in our four-part series on the Vietnam War. We'd like to thank G. Kurt Peeler, Director of the Center for the Study of War and Society at the University of Tennessee, for his help in organizing this series. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians and invite you to send us your comments either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.